Members will call the meeting to order. This is a joint meeting of the House Health and Human Services Reform Committee and the House Health and Human Services Finance Committee. I will be chairing the meeting today. Chairman Abler is going to be presenting his omnibus bill. The pages, audience members and members of the committees, will be handing out the bill. Okay, and they'll hand it out to audience members as well, so we don't end up in a traffic jam, if you will, trying to get up to the table and get copies of it. So as you can see, they're handing it out currently to the members, and then they will also come up into the audience and hand them out to each of you as well. If anybody didn't get one, just raise your hand, flag down a page, and they'll get you one. That way we can kind of keep it orderly. Representative Abler?
Well, thank you. I think there's eight amendments, something like that. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and to the room here and the public.
We are on the EC-45 amendment, am I correct?
Right, and we're working. There's actually a bill before us, or at least that we're working off of officially. We're not doing any bill? Okay, fine. So we're talking about amendments today. Anyway, thank you, Christine. Let me just outline for the all the interested parties what I see as the process that's going to unfold over the next 2 months. The beginning of that process is today, where I could have 30 chairs up here with me with people who have helped put this together from groups that you would all recognize and appreciate. Some of those members have been confidential with me because they knew what they should do, but they couldn't do it because of their constraints with their work. Like someone get fired, which would be bad, and then they wouldn't give me ideas. That would be people from departments, people from lobbying agencies, people from private nonprofits, people from the public, local people to me, etc. And so we are facing a challenge the likes of which no one has ever seen. I think now in the world, between our now only $5 billion deficit from 6.2, the federal government's $1.6 trillion or better deficit, the Japanese who have had their life, my mom always calls this time. She's still proud of Jimmy.
Members, maybe I could take this moment to mention, I think Representative Abler's goal is to present the bill, and then we'll open it up to discussions and questions. So, take notes, hold your questions until, and that way we can kind of keep things moving.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bert.
So I want to give you the short overview, and then that's exactly a good point to get that off. But this is quite a time, and so people have been very gracious in coming forward to me to offer some advice, and I've tried to capsulize that. The staff has worked really hard, the House Research staff in particular, trying to take these ideas and putting them into language. And many of these ideas are not new. Some are old standbys, some are new. And that's the purpose of today in this process. And so vetting-wise, we have today. And tonight, if you want to come back and discuss these at more length, we have, on Monday at 12:30, the amendment of the delete all to whatever bill we're working off of will be available online. There'll be hard copies available at noon or so on Tuesday. And then I'll present the more total version. These elements and amendments that we'll think of along the way to this language will be part of that, as well as the money. There's a little bit of money scattered through these amendments just because it made more sense. That money is not final, it's just kind of placeholder money. And then on Wednesday we'll take testimony, and we'll be here as long as it takes to hear from everybody who wants to comment. And my phone I publish, so they can call me, not during meetings. And then on Thursday we'll mark the bill up and get out of here at least by midnight that night. And then this will go to Ways and Means midweek or so, and the week after that or so it hits the floor. And then it goes off to an interesting process in the Senate where our bills will match up at least a little. There will be a discussion at length about revenue, and our bill will go out before or after that. I don't know which. I predict if it goes out before, it won't be as successful as if it goes out afterward. That's a discussion beyond my pay grade. But I want to thank the people who have put their best effort into this, and I get to be the mouthpiece for them. Some will, you'll know who they were, and others you won't. But I intend today to go through these eight amendments relatively at a high level And then we'll spend an hour or so talking about the detail of them, and then tonight if you decide that's important. So that's just a general thing. And the First Amendment we're going to work off is the EC 045. And there's no big theme to how these are being enrolled. They're just articles, the EC 045 amendment. And they're not put in any kind of marketing thing. They're just kind of, here's an amendment. And as we go through an article and a bill, sort of, and these are language actually designed to be articles. And so the highlights, I'm not even going to tell you the sections, just to give you the highlights, and you can read through. But there's about 10 highlights out of this, and some are relatively major. Probably the key thing about this amendment has to do with Merck. I've got to find $30 million more. I'm getting close to my target, and I'm still looking for that money if anybody. Thanks to UCARE, by the way, for chipping in 30 to the state. That was did you hear about that? They probably had a press conference about that, but that was pretty cool. And I don't get that, by the way. In terms of Merck, Merck has been reformed a number of times under my time, and I see it as a nice pot of money going to great places that we have no accountability for or no outcomes that we expect. The governor made some retrenchments to that. So far in my target, I don't have those retrenchments. I'm hoping to hold out against that. But I'd rather redefine the money to be more directed toward health disparities and more toward deep and isolated rural training sites so that we can actually help the disparities that we say we care so much about. I won't try to editorialize too much, but that's what drives me in this. And you'll see in the work I'm providing to you a lot of effort at health disparities. And when I was a freshman, we threw money at it, and it didn't make a dent. And so we have to do it smart. We have to do it culturally competent. We have to do it with people who would interface in a natural way with the community of disparity they're trying to influence, which would be people who would be of the same, race or demographic. And so you'll see in there some language about that. That's a placeholder that moves us. We create some grants and some loan forgivenesses. We've shifted a lot of those programs into these sort of things. And one thing else, it's kind of scattered throughout, but Native American health disparities, to me, are an embarrassment. We have done nothing but harm as a Caucasian to that group of folks. They were fine before we got here, and they're not fine now, and we keep thinking that we can make them fine with our great ideas. White Earth in particular has enough mass and enough capacity through these bills. We're going to give them the ability to run their own social service programs and run their own work. If you're a White Earth tribal member, there's 10,000 or so in Minneapolis, apparently 30,000 altogether, 10,000 on their reservation. There is no White Earth clinic in Minneapolis, and so they'd rather go to the reservation than go to the doctor, which means they may not get there anytime soon. And so one of the proposals here is to give them one or more clinics that would be culturally competent to address that and actually make them try to be healthy. In this amendment, there's an exception with e-health. Some of these small clinics are going to die trying to do that. For a small clinic, $5,000 or $10,000 is a lot. We push off the effective date to 2020. There's some e-prescribing issues that are related to the prior authorizations for the pharmaceutical things. There's two parts that make e-prescribing more streamlined about that. There's a number of nursing home administrator changes where we attempt to move them toward federal standards and deem licenses that are similar. We did quite a bit of discussion about that already, I think, on the Hamilton bill. There's a bunch of community health clinic grants. Throughout the bills, you're going to see that we're trying to focus on primary care and outreach to areas who need outreach. The community health clinics, to me, seem like a stellar example of that. And there's some grants to help to have more of those and help them actually become training entities for people. If there is a Bowabic clinic, which I should go visit it sometime. But anyway, I talk about the clinic in Bowabic, which they must have one. And if it seems like people who know how to be more culturally competent and more reaching into the early MA, the old GAMC population, would be helpful to help them to to learn about how to do that better, and we're trying to use those as direct sites, the 55 of them, as well as vectors of training. We asked the commissioner to do a health disparity survey relative to the workforce, relative to this health disparities. There's a little piece about flexibility for plumbing in this particular article. When the cities are delegated duties under the health department, you know, restaurant licensing and so on, they have no flexibility about trivial things that could work fine. And so this gives them flexibility that'll probably come up for more discussion. In this area of less state employees and pressure on budgets, my view at this point is to take the governor's level of staff management. But even so, I'm not convinced that's a safe level. I think our state workers have been under a lot of pressure in the past several years, and I think that they're stretched thin. And so if we're going to have less of them, then we need to help them do their work more effectively. And in guidance for that, in this article, we do some transfers of responsibilities, primarily from the health department. It's nothing against the health department. It's just that they have duties that their focus has grown from health to things that they're not necessarily focused on or that other departments do already in a very grand way. Four areas. Health economics could go to commerce, which I proposed, and they could then do all of health economics. Facility licensing could go to DHS, and the staff could go. This isn't a way to just lose all those staff. It's taking the responsibilities, and then somebody would decide what the right number is. And my view of state employees is to reduce by attrition and by need, not by artificial number that comes up just because we have to hit a target. I thought the HMO regulation, we've always discussed this, that should go to commerce, and that's, if I didn't put that there, you'd think something was missing. And then this this data health analysis stuff, Department of Health has it, DHS has a couple pots of it with the fee-for-service and the managed care. I thought they should all be grouped together someplace, probably at DHS, because they're the ones contracting for care. And the services I'm interested in scrutinizing and being looking after are the ones that we help subsidize, which would be the MA and Minnesota Care. I'm not really interested in the commercial part to meddle with that. That's really not the department, our coverage area. So that's the stuff in EC 45. And now if you want to go to some of the next one, if we can do the L series, is there a LA 50? And why don't you pass out LA 50, 51, and 52? I'm trying to go kind of fast to give you the broad view to leave time for a good discussion at the end. So,
I'm getting some members raising their hand. What I'm doing is putting people on a list in order, and unless somebody has a real serious objection, we'll do what we talked about doing, and that's let Representative Abler present these. Keep notes about your questions and then ask them at the end. Thank you.
Okay, LA 50, if you have that, that actually reiterates some of the tribal stuff. It goes, and you'll be getting their copies. We've already discussed a lot of this. Some of these, this white earth and tribal element is covered in a couple of different parts. The different staff have different areas of responsibility. This one transfers the social service function to the white earth group in conjunction with the commissioner's work. It also does some work on service delivery authorities.
Members, just for clarification, we are on the LA050, the LA 50.
And it's a small one. The service delivery authorities is an effort to consolidate county functions. This has been discussed widely in the last at least 2 years, if not beyond. Given the times, it seems helpful to move counties in a strong carrot way to want to embrace this. And I've had discussions with the AFSCME 5 and 65 about some of the concerns that come up with this sort of thing. There's even a placeholder or language someplace in this to make sure that they're protected in terms of their benefits that they had, which this is not an effort to do anything about that. And so basically, through the course of this amendment and others, if one or more counties totaling 55,000 or more people, or four counties in four or five counties in geographic non-proximity, in proximity that want to get together. It's language to them, sorry. Pretty much if you're 55,000, a group of counties or more, which would include all the metro counties to start with, and they want to be a service delivery authority, they get to be one. They are given the flexibility to not have to do a number of the maintenances of effort, and they can actually serve their people in the way that they deem best for their particular group. The philosophy here is that the county boards and the social service directors actually care a lot about their county people, and they know what they look like, they know the needs, and they can focus their resources. So far, I mean, I shouldn't announce things, but so far in my draft, I've not had to cut CCSA grants, and so that's part of a backup to keep them intact on this duty. I also create in this amendment an informal conference. One of the things, and I don't know if it exists or not, but it seems like talking to the people, they don't have an informal conference. If you've been having your waiver level of need determined, if that's been changed, you think you have to go to a formal appeal, which is burdensome and expensive and clumsy. I create a specific informal conference here where that if you don't like what happened to you, you can get a meeting set up with your case manager and the social service director or designee and talk about it. And in some cases, there's just ridiculous awards that anybody who's sensible would have said, why would they give you so little? And in some cases, there was a reason, and if the people understood the reason in a setting where they got the context, they could do it. And maybe they'd say, well, try it for 2 weeks, and we'll see how you do it. Here's my number. Call me directly. And that's the 050 amendment. If we can go to 051 next, Mr. Chair. Are those out?
Very good. We're moving on to the LA-051.
Okay.
Document.
And then, so with all the talk about sex offenders, there's some work I would like to do yet this cycle, this being this year and next. It seems that there's some interesting news about how different counties decide to send the offenders. And so as a way to encourage counties to be a bit more thoughtful about this, I increased their share to 30% from 10. And so there's some people who absolutely should be put away, and I couldn't agree more. And this will help that discussion to go forward. And the counties, surprisingly, weren't that eager about this element. I don't understand that. But anyway, there's some language in here we're going to put. There's some language about MITO. And in the budget, when it comes out, you'll see some other work on MITO. You can read it. It says that they'll be laid off if there's being laid off for lack of work is not a redesign layoff. I think that's basically what it says. And if anybody agrees, that makes sense because they felt constrained up there to keep people on. It sounds like so. This discussion will go on at some length. Also, in this amendment is the White Earth Chemical Mental Health Award of Services. Also in this is the chemical mental health section. We, having met some people who have been through 19 treatment times of chemical dependency treatment and some people who can't get any, it seems like we would be prudent to address this. And what this does, it limits them to 3 and 4 years and 4 for their lifetime. And thinking in a humane way that maybe if they know they only get a few, they'd actually work at it. According to one of my sources, that sometimes people take these treatment things as a way to get housing. In my proposal, I don't reduce the base rate for group residential housing. So I'm trying to hit it from both sides here. There's a study about behavioral health hospitals, what to do with them, and the commissioner's to look at that. There's no instruction to do anything specific, but in my view, as I've learned a lot in this role, everybody seems to want to talk to me now, and I talked to a lot of folks. I didn't realize there were so many people that would talk to you. That I've come to the conclusion that our mental health system is not seamless. That's the nicest way I can think of to say it. And so with some of the work about this, maybe we can come out of the session with some work with the new deputy commissioner or assistant commissioner, whatever Maureen is, and get something productive. And serve people better on a budget. There's a proposal to look at intensive dual diagnosis treatment as well at the last page of this. So if the 52
members of the LA 052 amendment,
and I'm out of amendments after this one. I need four more. This is the Health Licensing Board's one, and I was debating. I've been working on this project in some cases for a year. This has been worked out with the Health Licensing Boards, and to my understanding, they're totally cool with all this. We have sent draft after draft back and forth, and if there's something that is yet objectionable, I'm naive to that, and we'll address it. And I decided to put it in this bill because we had a whole article of licensing fees anyway, and a bunch of fee changes that the boards do for the new members. We appropriate all the boards' money to them, which is all fee-based. Occasionally, we sweep the money, which always seems tempting. There'll be language coming that will segment their money even more. So if we sweep the money, we have to take $10 million from the medical doctors, $5 million from the nurses, so there's a face on it, so we can't just take an unspecified $15 million and think it's not going to hurt anybody. Every penny in this special revenue fund is paid by licensees, and it's designed, the fees are set at the point at which they can conduct their services. And so the most interesting things about this bill would be the follow-up from last year. There was issue with the chiropractic board, and there was some sex offender bad behaving chiropractor in the paper, which provoked a discussion about what do you do with sex offender chiropractors, and none of us wanted to. It was just we all said, send them far away. And so that provoked a discussion about what the boards did. We found out that only the medical board had any standards about what to do with that particular amount, how that was a disqualifying piece. And so the House position last year was to have all the boards subject their members to dismissal, and they can't become that if they are, or if they reoffend in that way or offend, they couldn't get their license renewed. And so the compromise was that the chiropractors did that one, and then it was sent out to the boards to work on. After a lengthy discussion, the board adopted, with a small exception, the language that was adopted. All the boards adopted the request to be included in that, with the exception of the psychologists, and I decided they should be included too. So that's that piece. It's language that was passed the House. We had a very thoughtful conference committee about it, and except that we added language about if you've had a sex offense and your license, you can't renew your license because that would be a disqualifying thing. We did close one little loophole about that. The other things that are in are kind of making some more consistency in how the health boards conduct their complaint process. Record keeping is common. We make that the level of a parking ticket, and they can send out some tutorials. It doesn't qualify as a disciplinary action. There's a bunch of small things. The boards all have small matters that they have to deal with, and those are in there, and we can discuss those during the question time. A number of the boards are here. None of them are controversial. There was if a board, I've learned about the controversy. There's the nursing proposal, which is being carried by Representative McElfatrick, has a border state piece that's not in here. That's controversial. If we did that talk about repealing. That was like the compact thing, so I said, we're not doing that here. This is all the non-controversial, bland stuff. If it's not bland, let me know, and we'll address it. Just to give the barbers and cosmetologists credit, they weren't included in our original list of people who might want to be excluded from the sex offender thing. They volunteered. They said, we want to be at the same standard as all the rest of the licensees, so they're included as well. So that's that. And now to the next, LA 53, do you have that one? This is the miscellaneous article.
Representative Abler, I don't think we have the LA 53 out. We do have the DP 66.
I'll do that one then.
Let's do that one.
Very good. What one do you have? Okay, we need some more.
Pages, if you could hand out DP 66.
Okay,
we'll hang on while people get a hold of that.
Yeah. And part of the DP 66 will be discussed tomorrow. This is the Lutheran Social Service care coordination program. And that's, I'm not going to touch on it except to say it's in here, and we'll be talking about it at length tomorrow. If you look through all of the work you're going to see, it's about taking away administrative burden on people that we can't give any money to, which would be nursing homes, ICFMRs, different service groups where they're already credentialed one place. There may be some details to work out about some of those we want to hang on to, but in general, a lot of it is simply duplicative. They have to file two reports. There's two oversights, maybe two staff. And so you'll see some ICF DD license duplication language in here. You'll see moving from allowing to go from 6 to 16 beds, if it makes sense. Not for everybody, just those it makes sense for. It allows PCAs to do rehab work. It was brought to my attention that they could go out there and do everything, but if it was on the rehab list, they couldn't do it. They're like, really? So we allow them to do that. We don't reduce any PCA services in here, except we do reduce family and friends, the family rates, by 20%. If you're a daughter or serving your mom, it's 20% less. We do some 1915K work from the disability, from Ann Henry's group, is in here as a draft. There's some long-term care imperative stuff in here, which is a lot of this duplication that we heard on the Hamilton bill. I believe that's that part of it. And then we, the TEFRA changes that were done before, we didn't raise any TEFRA rates, we just made them permanent. We freeze nursing home property rates. We don't cut them. In my, so far within $30 million, I haven't cut nursing home rates. This is a whole placeholder for a lot of care coordination discussion. And some of this will be disparate. It won't fit. But the intention is we want to make care coordination effective, focused, and actually be helpful to the people who are being served and focus the level of need correctly. Part of the work that's in here is a discharge plan for everybody who's on a waiver, knowing that it can be discharged per se, but at six-month intervals, they'll be reevaluated and scrutinized relative to the level of need and to say, is this the right provider that they should even be at? Can they be more independent? Is this the it seems like sometimes people get a client and they have a pipeline of services which goes up by inflation, and we are moving away from protecting vendors to protecting clients and the people we serve. Hopefully soft landing vendors, and if there's any that we affect inadvertently, I didn't mean it, but we have to do something a bit different. In this draft, we also abolished the Governor's Council on Development of Disabilities, and that's in there. Those duties will be taken over by another council. We have the commissioner look at, should we create co-pays for the health and for the waivers, much like we do TEFRA. Some families have means, should they chip in? We allow the waiver beds to go from 4 to 8 if it makes sense. There's one that met with me, they have a duplex, and they're licensed separately, and they cut a door, and now they have two licensed things, and at least now they could share a nurse, they could share administrative. And these are all to be scrutinized by the case managers and the counties who are going to be awarding services. So there's a PCA study for the commissioner to see if they can improve on things further. I think they can. There's also a discussion about that they should look at the ICF DDs, which are seem like a dinosaur, at least in certain cases. Every year they go down, and to see what's the right number to soft land at. And I'm convinced that 4 is not the right number, and I'm convinced that 200 is not the right number of places to help people live. And I think the pendulum has gone a bit far to the 4, and we're coming back to the middle where it makes sense for the welfare of the client and some administrative functionality. To me, the welfare of the client is prime. And some people, it seems like, I hear, they like their group, and they're content, and they don't want to leave. And for all of our help, we shouldn't help them to be unhappy. That's that. Which one do you want next, Mr. Chair?
Representative Abel, we're going to do LA 53. So if the pages could hand out LA 53 at this time.
This is the miscellaneous one. This suggests that we should start looking at the impact on the things we do on the cost of health care for various groups, including public employees, state health programs, private employers. It creates a health impact note or a health note, which I thought would be an interesting way to see what have we really done elsewhere. Sometimes we live on a little bit of a vacuum and we don't know what we did, or we know it and we just kind of turn an eye. I especially, just to the members and public, if I've done something I didn't intend, I don't want to do that. If there's things I didn't intend, well, I'm sorry, or I'm not sorry. But anyway, so then this also allows, we're having a hearing, I think, today on the daycare thing, so I think we'll leave that. Is that today? We're not doing that? Okay. Anyway, so I'll tell you about it here then. There was a, there's a situation where a licensed home provider can have 10 or 14 people, depending upon if they have one or two workers. And then it works out good when the kids are little, but the kids become 16 and they're sick of having daycare in their house. And so this would allow for standards that are safe where this licensed home could become a licensed home in a, you know, in a storefront or someplace. I've worked with the department on this. They're not officially saying that they support it or endorse it. But it turns out that the 16-year-old kid that comes home from school with sick having daycare in their house is a common infractor on these little 5-year-olds. And so you never would have been in the situation had the kid's not been there. And so this way you take away from temptation, from opportunity, and in fact there would be less of those cases in this situation, that's a benefit that I hadn't thought of. The pay would be the same. There's no add-on for the facilities. The same inspections would continue to be safe. And if you look at some of the standards homes have, it's pretty much have a fire, you know, you have to have a fire alarm and sheetrock the basement and stairway so it doesn't burn through. And so this is actually an improvement. There's a Hackbarth bill that's on the calendar that involves elevators. The nursing homes are concerned about that the new elevator standards are going to impact them. I don't know where that bill is going. It's already passed committee, so I put it in here just to make sure that we can help everybody. It gives 3 more years for people to comply with the elevator standards. It doesn't change any. I would have actually changed more of the standards, but I'm taking the middle road here. And then there's one of the things that I think is going to really help in the appeals is a group that's going to talk about the definition of adequacy. The big question that comes when you start doing case management and allocation of services statewide, where it's all over the map what they get, is that we argue what is adequate. And then the judge decides and may even award services beyond what's even on the service menu. Like, really? And so that's doesn't help. And so this would get away from adversarial to actually looking at the need of the client and what can they do. And so between the LSS model and the other ones, this is hoping a way to kind of address that. And that's the end of LA 53.
Okay, Representative Abler and members, the next one is DP 67. It's being handed out right now.
Okay.
DP 67.
And this is the Children and Family Services one. And I appreciate people bearing with me going through this. I'm trying to be high level. It's going pretty well, I think, just to get to the topics, and then you can know which ones you want to discuss in more detail. And so this is... one thing that you'll see in the themes of my work, I don't do a lot of the traditional $150 housing allowance and all that stuff in my work. It doesn't generate much money, and it just causes a lot of angst. And but what I'm trying to do in everything, in the waiver programs and in the general assistance and the MA program, in the MemPIP stuff, where we touch it, is to move people on a path. A path to somewhere, a path from where they are to somewhere, and a path to security, and then a path from security to more independence, a path from more independence to total independence. That's what we're about. And so you'll see in this, in the general assistance program, which I leave funded at the rate, we require that these individuals getting this have to do 20 hours of volunteer work. And it would be regulated by the county and overseen by the whatever caseworker put them on there. And I don't care for whom they do work. And I don't even mind that it's really hard work. But I want them to be doing some things. And if you do 20 hours times 10 bucks, that's $200 they get. And it's kind of an exchange. And talking to my homeless shelter in my district, they like this because then they can show a community benefit And the same requirement would apply to group residential housing people as well.
Mr.
You
Chair.
Wouldn't probably have to have both. You just have one or the other. There's a lot to get both.
Representative Hosh, real quickly, again, members, we are trying to keep a list of people for questions after Representative Abler's done. We have just one more to get through, and then we can open it up for full discussion.
Mr. Representative Hosh. I'm not tracking Representative Abler's comments to the DP 67. Am I?
There's a, I don't know what section it is. In there, there's a general assistance eligibility language, and I can't tell you what section is. I didn't. Am I in the wrong one?
Section.
Oh, I'm sorry. DP.
It's section 4.
I'm telling you the wrong one. I'm on.
That's we're on the wrong one, Mr. Chair. That's.
Am I in the? Am I right?
Representative Hosh, we're on DP 67.
Am I in the wrong one or am I? Okay. I'm sorry to confuse you. It's been a lot of confusion. Anyway, so that's the idea. We also reintroduced the at-home infant care program. We take, I think we're taking 1% or something. We reduce the rate by 2%, okay, which is a set aside from the basic sliding fee. we reduce the rate by 20% from the rate to help mothers stay home. No one can argue. This is actually a Representative Mulder proposal from back in the day, Representative Schumacher, dusting it off. And it seemed like a nice idea, and it keeps mothers home a little longer with their child, and no one's going to argue that that's a good idea. And so we took the tiny bit of money. I don't think they spent all the money before is what happened. It just kind of attrited away. So we'll see where it goes. And I think we want to make sure if it's not used, it can go back into the basic sliding fee. So Representative Slavik, you can help me make sure that it's not just sequestered. And so it's meant to be available. And anyway, so we reduced family and friends child care by 20%. Those are the only rate changes I make to the child care rates. We increased income register guard for GA to 150. That's all dollars. That's that path. That's on a path. At least they can keep 100 more dollars. They get a little bit of work. They can, you know, a lot of them, sometimes they probably work for cash. But at least this way they could get a bona fide job and still retain some of their assistance. There's a number of things here about the relief of the counties need some timing help because they can't get their work done on time. And there's some of that. And there's also a piece which came from one of my homeless shelters in my district about a pilot project for homeless adults to be in-home caretakers of foreclosed homes. And it's a little novel, and it doesn't take any money, but it gives some credibility to the fact that one of my good banks has some vacant homes in my town, and this would give standing that they could have then four individuals live there, and somebody pay utilities, and then the house is not empty. And in my town, we have at least at one point we had 156 vacant homes in my little town, which seems like a lot to me. So that's just meant to be a kind of a interesting no cost thing. So that's the end of that. And then last, I have probably the largest amendment.
Members, the last one is RC 83-1. RC 83-1. It is being handed out now.
And we're doing pretty good. And so I'll take a few minutes and go through this. This is all the healthcare stuff. Anyway, so the just since we repealed the healthcare access fund, which unfortunately gets us $50,000 in per diems. I thought it was worth $250,000, but we actually pay staff out of that. So it seems like if you wanted to do that kind of work, with all respect, Representative Huntley, I enjoyed every meeting. But we could get a joint meeting and actually talk about it. So trying to save little bits of money. And that's actually one state employee that we keep because we do that. there's some language in there about non-payment of medical errors. There's a handshake agreement with some hospitals, but I'm putting more teeth in that if you cut off the wrong leg, we're not paying for it. And in fact, I'd like to have people, I'll leave it at that. There's a lot of work on community clinics. The CHCCs, if you're one of those, and if you're a healthcare home, we're liking that. We're trying to broaden that out to be even a bigger use. There's a outreach program from the Level 3 pediatric hospitals that the commissioner will help them direct their efforts. This is actually a Huntley idea, that they should go within a radius of their clinic and look at low birth weight babies and see if they could do something. I know Children's has a project for this already. And we want more projects and more prevention. And so they would work with public health, et cetera. And if there's any themes in this, it's more collaboration, coordination, focus on the past, and let's help some people. There's some federal compliance with emergency medical assistance that I didn't write. There's a care coordination. Dr. Ann Kelly had youth special kids. We created a care coordination program for medically fragile kids who spend $100,000 or more in the previous year or think we're gonna. And this has been quite collaborative in getting this put together. An advanced practice nurse would be the coordinator at each of, I think, 4 pediatric hospitals and would coordinate the care they get. This approach can save a ton of money, but even more than the money. Money is important these days, but even more than the money is they help the families to manage their own fragile child. These kids are usually not going to get well, and their whole life is just so disrupted. But if they cannot have to go to the ER, that's actually better. And they can manage the challenge at home, and they get to know the cases. And at her place, it was remarkable to go visit that. And we're trying to import that, what they've learned. We forbid paying for C-sections earlier than 39 weeks unless it's an emergency. We don't pay for repeat tests. I don't do hardly any rate work at all, but there's some reason that the OTs and PTs get a better price if the person's in the room, and so we roll that back. I haven't heard that yet, but that's in there. There was a technical thing on the Cairo thing last year. Of all things, I have to work on that. They cut the Minnesota care. There was no savings for it, and this is an effort to put that back. We cover acupuncture by people who are trained or certified to do it. Just something, there's also a study in here about this. Because you have a license to do it, it means we pay you to do it. You don't have to even be good at it if it's in your license. And I asked the health services, there's a group at DHS that does some review of this. I asked them to look at that and see what they can make of that. In a time when we're desperately trying to serve people and removing some people from healthcare, and it seems like we should make sure that we're paying people who actually are good at what they do. So I don't have language to do that, but I asked them to talk about it. The pharmacy issue, one in Duluth just closed, and I'm sad to hear that, and now they've been merged with a very large one. We've heard a lot about pharmacies and the ingredient rates they're paid and how they can't stay in business. I think it's $1 million worth that I'm trying to find to improve the deep rural and isolated rural rates by 2% for ingredients if there's a chain of 4 or less. And hopefully this will be a way to keep them wanting to serve our nursing home people in MA. This is one of those things, everybody didn't like it and there's nothing to do about it, and maybe this is a way at least to take care of those who are the most at risk. We adjust copays in both Minnesota Care and MA. In the MA, there's a Deloitte study that says if you increase the copays to high-cost providers, that they won't go there as much. And in my work, you've heard a lot. If you've heard nothing in my talk, it's all about we can't be throwing money away on services that the profession as a group doesn't deem to be a necessary number. And there's language that will be in this bill to manage HMOs by a factor, I think, of 10% based on that. And I'm absolutely serious about this, and I think that's where the money is. And I think you can provide that level of management and cause no harm to anybody at the patient end, and actually leave 60% of the providers alone and let them enjoy their right to practice. I hear nothing but complaints from people who are overburdened by reviews from well-intended reviewers who are only annoyed at the end because they were fine. And so this is my effort at that. We do, I mentioned healthcare homes, and we allow mental health professionals to take over the role of leading one of those. There's some deeming. If you've listened to me for the last couple of years, you would hear me say I thought the FQHCs would make great healthcare homes. A lot of them didn't even apply because it was too burdensome to get the small amount of money. And so this bill deems them and gives flexibility about how they can meet their backup for the fiscal responsibilities. And then we also require, we want to build off the successes part of the CCDSs, and I'm trying to keep everybody in under services, so I'm with you on that. But we're trying to make everybody who can be made to go, if they have enough chronic conditions, they're going to be in a healthcare home. They have to go to one of those in MA. And especially of the single, the new expansion group, but I think in all the MA. And then the other ones have to pick a primary clinic. And like in the same way, I'm in CGIP, and I have our primary clinic is Ramsey. If I want to go in for something, we go there or call them to give us a referral. Works for us, and it could work for these folks. And it provides, I think, the oversight that we've been looking for and trying to contain the cost at absolutely no change in quality. We do provider tiering. I mentioned that. There's some rural demonstration projects. You'll see a bunch of effort on rural health and health disparity matters.
Chair, just continuing along the same line, Representative Abler, I want to be really clear for members about the deadline for amendments. So you're saying that we're going to mark up the bill on Thursday. So are you going to enforce a 24-hour rule on amendments?
Representative Abler.
There's a practical, it's going to be soft. If you know me at all, you know I don't want to be unfair. Part of the reason the language comes out now is this is most of the language. And so if you're going to spend money, that's a different question. And so if there's an idea some of these, to work on some of this takes a little bit of work, and the staff can't get an amendment put together in time. And so if there's an amendment in the pipeline, you know, by a reasonable time before the day before the meeting, but what I'm trying to handle is just can't think of ideas on the fly, and that's what I'm trying to, so that the process is thoughtful, staff can actually accomplish the work, we can make copies made. And so in the case of 24-hour rules on this, you've got a week already to work on these, and you actually might be surprised. If you have an amendment, I might like it, and there's other amendments you just have to do, but is that a fair enough answer? So we've not had many amendments to bills to be done anyway. But and so at some point the staff will say if you're thinking of it Thursday morning, they can't get it done, and I wouldn't accept probably one of those. But if you have an idea to Mr. Chun by morning on Wednesday, and it's not written yet, and that's I think that's fair, because you might not think of it till you heard the testimony, and even is that fair? I'm trying to be reasonable.
So. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And then just to be really clear about this, so these new, we've just seen a very quick run-through of some big policy pieces. And here we are in the joint committee. But so is it your intention that this, and Representative Gottwald, I guess the question goes to you too, are these policy pieces going to separately go to the policy committee, or is this it? For those pieces,
Representative Abler.
Well, this is probably it. Okay. And there'll be discussion. I think on Tuesday, when we do our bill, there'll be time to discuss them some more. That'll also be a joint hearing, and then amendments will be made on Thursday. So there's exposure twice.
Okay, and.
Yeah, Representative Liebling, I would concur. I think what you're seeing here today are most of the pieces of an omnibus bill, and the policy and peer finance pieces are together in that bill. So we will also have an omnibus policy bill at some point that will include a lot of the department bills and some of the non-money things that are not included in this bill. So we'll have that to look forward to.
And then,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you to both chairs for that. And then, just to be clear, I mean, in what you've laid out, Representative Abler, in this enormous policy change that we're looking at here, your enormous proposals, and some very creative, I'm sure, and I thank you for your openness about and willingness to be flexible and really consider the implications of all of this, but... in all of this, it just strikes me, we're giving the public only one day for testimony on basically a total shakeup of our health and human service system here in the state. And I just wonder if, is that your intention, that there would basically be one day for public testimony before we mark up and vote on this bill, and that's pretty much it?
Representative Abler.
Well, Representative Liebling, I actually share your concern. I think you want to not confuse testimony with input. there is they're different. Actually, I was just listening to a person on the radio yesterday who was complaining about how he had a hard time following the legislature, and he is a person who watches it a lot, and most of my citizens count on me to be their input here, and they count on you as well. And so, but I've met with, I should have counted, 300 or 400 different people since I've been designated the chair, which is more meetings than anybody I know has ever taken. And with the exception of probably 2 or 3 meetings, I've learned something from every group. And so some of those ideas are in here. And I intend to keep that same policy open. And so if the public would know to testify, they would know to read the amendment, they would know to comment to you or me. Along the course of this bill has a tremendous distance to go for any of it to become law, and a good deal of time will intervene. And so the public will have an opportunity to testify on Wednesday, as long as they care, and we'll probably have quite a group, I predict, and I don't know.
Representative Abler, Representative Liebling, we actually have people who have already signed up, and we're talking about 9.5 hours, maybe more, of testimony. That's...
And so then, but it Ways and Means, there's opportunity for public testimony. There's opportunity for public testimony in the conference committee. And if you know my style, it would be to actually listen to people that have something to say. In the past, the conference committee has been a relatively closed process. The House has been, in the process, has been habitually quite inclusive. There's some pieces of my bill that would look lame compared to the stuff that Senator Berglund dropped in our laps. Without even knowing what's in the bill entirely in conference committee, that had never been heard or even presented to anybody. And the people in the audience said, what did they do? And those are people that are hired to be here as a professional in a system, and so I'm trying to do way better than that. And so that's the answer to your question. I believe there'll be a good chance for the public to have input along this long way, and they'll certainly get input with me if they call.
And Mr. Chair, just
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, and just a quick follow-up to that, and that is, are there, right now, I think it would be fair to tell the public what restrictions there might be on their testimony. In other words, are we planning to give each testifier 2 minutes, or, you know, can you lay that out right now? I mean, I think, you know, we might differ about whether that's adequate public input, and I guess the public will get to weigh in, you know, it is what it is, and I don't know how it compares to what's been done in the past or what may be done in the future, and I'm not responsible for whatever a senator or another representative did in the past.
Two thoughts.
So that's the question. What restrictions? Is it going to be 2 minutes, or is it going to be so much per group, or how do you plan to structure that?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I think that we've tried to be fair. If, you know, some people have more to say, and I think we'll be fair about that. I don't know how long the list is, and it depends how long you all want to sit there. I'll just tell you, though, testimony that goes on for 20 minutes, at the end of the fourth minute, no one's listening anymore, at least my observation. A few are, but as a group, it's not effective. And so if you go to any committee, and I've been at many witness tables over my 13 years, even when I'm testifying on something I want their help on, I hope that they're actually engaged in the discussion. And so just to the public, it's prudent to, if you want a written thing so we can read it, that's specific comments to the bill are helpful. Line 14, you know, page 14, line 7, I would change it this way. If you don't like what we're doing, then give me an alternative. And if it involves, you know, the angel came and her alternative was revenue, that's fine. I gave her more time. I gave her 5 minutes instead of 3 when she came, if you recall her particular appearance. And she went on about revenue, and I let her do that. Because she needed the time to express herself. And I hope you think that I'll be fair enough to let each person get their point across. But also, I would like enough people to be at the table for the last witness so that they get the respect that the first witness got. So that's the burden of the time. And if written testimony is very helpful, and specifics are even more helpful. So that's a, is that, so we'll, I'll be fair, and you can help me.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just, you know, kind of going off a little bit on this, and I just a little bit of frustration. I mean, within this, there's, I counted 204 pages, and I would say this doesn't come close to achieving the $1.86 billion target overall that we have. If you were to put what's in these 204 pages onto a spreadsheet at this point. And, you know, as we move forward, we really, as a committee, haven't heard any of this policy. The majority of the bills, if you aggregated all the bills that we heard in the Finance Committee, there would have been a net increase in expenditures in the state, because most of the bills we had, increases to nursing homes, blank expenditure appropriations, and those type of items. And we haven't focused on the policy and the impact on finances. And my concern is we are going to have a bill that is going to be much more comprehensive on Monday when it's released, with more information attached to a spreadsheet. I would be safe to assume it'd be 300 plus pages. And we are essentially are going to have 48 hours to disseminate that information, try to get input by those who are affected on our own personal behalf, not just as a committee. And Mr. Chair, I know that you have a lot more people knocking on your door because you hold the gavel. But I would like to get that input as much as possible too, to see what kind of response I think would be appropriate, and then try to put together the amendments. And for a committee and for a legislature that has so many new individuals, I just feel like this is rushed. You know, Mr. Chair, you know, on the PCA bill that I carried, or with the dental services that the former Representative Bunn worked on, or all the different other areas that we saved significant dollars on, we had hearings on those individual components in the past, and we haven't done that yet. And I hope we have time and flexibility, not only for testimony, but for amendments. And there'll be long days, but, you know, if we've got 9.5 hours of testimony scheduled for that, that's about $200 million an hour for the target that we have to reach. This is a lot of money, a lot of people that are being affected, and we're not going to have the details until Monday on it. I do appreciate your efforts on this, and I do appreciate some of the reform areas that you have, but that's only going to take more time to get input on and to see what the real impacts are going to be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, your point is true to a point. There'll be a spreadsheet with numbers, and that's always sort of the surprise. Each group in charge kind of holds that to the end, and because they're still working on it and hoping some miracle happen or half of it goes away and they don't have to do it, you know. I don't see any miracle happening about that. You'll see some plug numbers in some of these things, and you can do your own math to see where some savings come, where you can see where I'm thinking to go. And so you'll be less surprised than if you analyze the numbers and the language in there and how I might go about it. You'll see less new material than you think about some of those items. If you haven't heard me mention, we need to manage high-cost providers in healthcare. The language to do that, my placeholder language, the best language I got today, is in there. If you see me talking about properly awarding level of need to people on disability waivers and giving counties flexibility to do it, it's in there. And if you do the math, those are the two big pots of money that are available to us, unless I'm not going to cut rates. I'll tell you my philosophy, and I'm in earnest about this. If you're going to expect the provider to continue serving people, be it a provider of PCAs or the PCA themselves, and you think that they're going to do it by cutting their rates, we're out of our mind. The providers I've talked to, the groups, would much rather have the right amount of services delivered at full price where they're better scrutinized. And that's been my talk all the way through, and you'll see language in there as you analyze it that would enable that. If we can't do that, the bill will look like bills you've already seen. I spent very little time criticizing our governor for his bill, but I want to remind you that overall, he had $4.1 billion of new money to spend, and over the course of his budget, he cut $800 million out of human services programs, which is my target is only twice that. And there's nothing I adopted. There's a few things in his bill I liked. I don't like the big ticket items in there that he did. I'm uncomfortable with that. And so just to remind you that even with $4 billion, it's hard to keep it whole. And so for the people at home who think if I can raise more revenue to simply stave off the inevitable, that we're going to be fine. I mean, Mr. Dayton is a good man. I like Commissioner Jessen. I spent no time picking apart the choices they made. I said, I hope to do better. And so, but it is important qualitatively to notice that given the choices they made and the decisions they chose with their money, that they didn't choose us. And they didn't choose these programs. And they didn't choose the providers. They didn't choose the people who deliver services. They didn't choose a lot of those groups. And it's their choice. And beyond this level of rhetoric, which I hopefully is gentle, they made their choice, and I'm going to pick mine. But I'm telling you, if we don't do something like what this bill suggests and the way we're doing it, you will find yourself in 4 years and 8 years having a system that collapses. And that's the urgency I feel. And I know you feel as well. And so I invite you to meet with me anytime you want about ideas that come up. And the public, I publish my cell phone as my home phone in the Red Book. It's my cell phone. So if you want to call me public, just call my phone and I will listen to you. And I'll pass on the messages if you want to be a public message. So we are in just the most grave of times. And I don't know how this all gets done, even what month we get done in. So I went on beyond answering your question, but that's my comment. So thank you. And I need all your help at the end of the day. And there'll be plenty of things to say how bad I was. And there'll be a postcard coming out in groups saying, oh, how can you do that? And I'm expecting that. But I had to make my own choices. And you'll see when my set of numbers that our side brings out, we will have made some choices about numbers that we will be accountable for.
Representative Hush. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Commissioner Chair Abler as well. I mean, I know you were saddled with a really tough assignment with a big, difficult target and some short time frames. At the same time, I mean, the reason why it's standing room only here is because it impacts a lot of people's lives. And serving on the policy committee, I have been dismayed, and I've shared that with Chair Gottwald, that we have canceled hearings. We've not spent time looking at these areas in which you're proposing major, significant reforms. And to me, that is the job of the policy committee, is to hear from the people whose lives would be affected about what they think is working and not working in these programs, and to float potentially some of these ideas so that they actually get thoughtful analysis and impact before we have to take those votes on the particular proposals. And I am concerned about how the process may allow time at 9 hours for professional lobbyists who represent various groups to respond, but not enough for the people who are really impacted and their families to come forward with their needs. And I mean, today I have met with three families who are dealing with severely challenged children whose ability to maintain a service system will be challenged by some of the changes that you have here. One woman did what we all hoped for. She stepped up and was a foster care mom and has adopted four kids with a lot of behavior challenges that started out as foster care children in her home. She can't keep PCA services given their behavior problems to keep that home together very effectively. There's constant turnover because it's kind of chaotic. And right now, other than one, she's down to two people, one of whom is a son of her own who is not disabled, who is working as a PCA, and he understands how to work with his adopted brothers. Under this bill, he gets cut to a rate of 80% what anyone else would pay. I worry about that family. They may not be connected to the organizations that are reading the details of the bills, but they're counting on me to get the word out so that I can get them to, so I can understand the impact. And I'm just afraid that the time frame you've laid out doesn't allow us to really understand what we're doing. And we need their wisdom and insights to advise us on how to go forward. And so I guess I'm saying if it's possible for you to slow this down, given what the burdens that have been put on you, I would really ask you to talk to your leadership about it and to let the Policy and Reform Committee do its job, which is to really analyze the impact of these decisions and to shape them in the least harmful way that we can. And I feel like we just haven't had a chance to do that yet. And this kind of reforms, I would have loved to have seen them in bills a week or so ago. Thanks.
Representative Vibler.
I understand. And just to offer you some word of encouragement, if you would like, I'm back to my input and process timing thing. The main thing is the main thing around here is getting an agreement about revenue. Whenever that happens, we can proceed. I didn't set the deadlines. We all get to operate under them, and you know how that works. But the good news about having this all pushed forward a month from what 2 years ago was, I just did the math. I looked at 2 years ago, and I would have liked that month a lot. However, by pushing it forward a month, you force us to put ideas on the table a month earlier. And that gives more time for the dialogue about the ideas that we propose to either be embraced or not. And so compared to the end, if you recall, we hardly agreed on targets 2 years ago in any kind of timely fashion. And so I think actually, given the quick schedule and all the stuff being out there sooner, there's more chance for public input. I don't think we should be fooled that the only public input that we get happens at this table when somebody can work their way up to the microphone. I'm not moving to Iowa for the next 2 months. We'll be seeing each other in the hallway. They'll be finding, somebody might wish I would, but we're all going to be together here. We're going to hear lots of input from our neighbors and from the people, and informal input is extremely productive, and from my experience here, one of the more valuable ones. So I wish it were slower. It's not. I'm comfortable that there'll be a lot of input and good productivity from the process here. Any questions about the content of this stuff here? I was just hoping for... I'd be open to one of those questions. Anybody?
Maybe from Representative Huntley.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, are we going to have fiscal notes before next Thursday?
Representative Abler.
There'll be a lot of fiscal notes. Some of the cases, I actually assign a number. Like in the case of the health plan management, I'm going to assign a number that will be giving the health plan, so I'll take my savings off of what I'll give them. In the case of the waivers, I'll be assigning a number that they'll be allocated. And so that'll be, you can just do arithmetic and get that. There are some fiscal notes that are, they're backed up, as you recall. If we're lacking one that I'm counting on, we'll have our best honest opinion about what we think it's going to generate. If it comes to the fact that it doesn't generate what we think, we'll be just where you were, and you'll have to argue the fiscal note or find some more money somewhere else or save more money because maybe we'll have a good surprise on one of them. That would be all right.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, so you're just going to sign some of the fiscal notes. You're not going to get them from the Office of Management and Budget.
Representative Abler.
Well, I don't know. My CA can tell you more about that. I'll give you an example. If some group got $90 last year and I'm going to give them $10 or $80, I'm going to presume I'm getting $10 out of that transaction. And so I don't need a fiscal note to tell me that that's worth $10. And so if it's simple math and we're allocating a different number, whether or not they put it in writing, I can be pretty confident that's going to get me $10. And so that's the example I'm talking about. And some other ones, like on the birth homes, I'm not taking any savings right now for that. I know it will save money. The pregnancy care homes, I know it will save money. I know it's going to keep women more whole and the babies less damaged and far less prematurity, far less low birth weight. Just tremendous benefits. That's got to be worth a ton of money. In my budget, I've not booked a penny for that, as an example that are things I know are going to come. So that's the best I can tell you. And you know exactly what I'm up against. So. That's probably why I asked the question.
Well,
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, if you look at the RC 83-1 on page 39, lines 3930, 3929, and 3930. You're cutting the capitation rates to health plans, which I assume they will pass those on to the providers, which they would have to do according to federal law. since the what we pay in capitation has to be actuarially sound. It's a federal law. And you're just assuming you're going to cut them 10%, and then you're just going to figure out what we paid last year, and you're going to take 10% of that and say we've collected savings, and you're not going to talk to management and budget about that.
Representative Abler.
I don't recall what our number has been if we took the expected forecast rate and reduced it by 10.
I understand.
But it would be, Mr. Chair, sorry. But it would be something on the order of that. I know if I appropriate a smaller number, then that's what the number is going to be. I'm glad you asked about a part of the bill. And the way I expect the health plans to do that would be by managing their high-cost providers. I'm absolutely convinced that we waste money in health care. And I didn't think of that myself. Senator Durenberger said that. I think you said that. And so the trick is finding it. And the first way to find it is the same as how you treat an alcoholic. You decide you want to find it and that you're willing to go after it. And so we admit that we have money we need to find. And everything we've done has been gentle and polite, even to the department's proposal about C-sections. We wish they wouldn't do them before 39 weeks. Well, I wish that, too. I'm not going to pay for it, and I'm sure I'll get some money that they'll give me in a fiscal note. That's not booked either. But if I don't want them to do C-sections before 39 weeks, I'm not going to pay for one in my bill. And I think that's how we need to govern this place. And we are the board of directors, all of us together, of this particular area. And I don't know how that analogy goes beyond this, but we're in charge. Nobody but this committee, being the joint group, in this body understands this stuff like we do. And they hope we're doing a good job. And the people, 800,000 people that we're looking after, with our $24 billion of money we spend, of which $10.7 billion will be general fund in this proposal we're bringing forward, is counting on us to look after them and make sure that services are there today, tomorrow, and in 5 years. And if they go to the clinic that they used to go to in 5 years and they're closed and there's no one to help them, they're going to be a little unhappy about that. That's the track we're on. And so that's what this is all about. And so we can look at various things and say, this doctor wasted some money. This doctor shouldn't have repeated a test. It was a waste of money. And so let's not pay for it. And that's worth tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. Everybody says there's enough money in the system. Okay, well, let's find that money. This is my effort. I'm open to your advice to find better ways to streamline this. But I'll tell you, if I don't put something in writing and take $200 million or whatever the amount I'm getting for this particular pot of writing, nobody in the audience wants to talk to me about it. If I have an idea, they're like, oh, okay, well, that'll go away. Well, now it's in a bill. It's out on Wednesday. And there'll be a lot of phone calls made tonight to the public, to various groups, and they'll be very interested to weigh in and discuss this topic now because it's moving in my bill, and which is the very dialogue I want. When I met United Healthcare Health Clinic, I think I was there with you, Representative Murphy, and at the hospital, and the doctors don't like peer grouping because it's, Medica did one, it's kind of ham-handed and not very smooth. And so I asked the doctors, I said, I understand, but if your mother comes here, and you are, there's some doctor you would rather your mother not see and one you wish your mother would see. And they all went like, you could see their eyes nodding. And I said, well, good. I don't want to send my patients to you them either. Tell me who is to you them either. Tell me who they are. They're like, oh, can't do that. I said, that's why we have peer grouping. Design the method for me that gets me these doctors and clinicians and chiropractors and psychologists and therapists of all varieties who do too much to people beyond what is customary and reasonable to do. Help me design it. If you don't design it, I'm doing this. If you don't design it, you're doing Medica. If you don't design it, you're cutting provider rates so nobody can work. Help us solve it as a group. And so, I don't mean to get carried away, but this is push is coming to shove. We're $5 billion in deficit this cycle, and there's more coming the next time. We're at $1.6 trillion in deficit at the federal government. Japan had a tsunami. They're going to have reactors starting to hurt people. That's the budget forecast, if you read the whole version, says our recovery is fragile. I don't know if Japan getting in trouble sells more grain or if it hurts our business. But nobody foresaw that in the forecast. The $5 billion we're counting on implies continued trade relations in the same way. So this is hard times, and this is, I was surprised the paper quoted me, this is not a drill. And so there's plenty of room for the politics, and I'm not, no one's doing that today. But there's plenty of room to do resolution and still be room for the statements we all want to make about how we would have done it different. So anyway, that's my, to your point, Representative Huntley, thanks for asking about part of the bill.
Well, Representative Huntley, I would also point out that language specifically that you cited has been turned into the Department for Fiscal Analysis, so we are actually looking at that through the department as well. Representative Huntley, did you have an initial question or
just
comment?
Just one last thing, Mr. Chair and Chair Abler. You know, I don't think we've ever passed a fiscal bill in my 19 years that didn't have the Office of Budget and Management tell us what the bill was going to cost. It has never, ever happened.
Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, overall, it's good to see what you're doing and how you did it. And I think there is a lot of good intentions here. But good intentions don't always make good policy, and that's something we're concerned about. And also, just to say, we know there's a deficit, but there's a lot of different ways to solve that deficit. And as you know, the governor's offered a different way. We don't necessarily have to make the cuts. But the question I wanted to ask is regarding early childhood policy, because that's the area I'm the lead on, is did I hear you say there's going to be no further changes to the child care area other than what we see in these bills?
Representative Weibler.
with the asterisk of the weekends coming and that those little bad surprises, at this point, I have booked no changes to child care rates in my budget, nor have I changed entrance level or exit level. If you recall in the past, we sat through this. And I hope you understand the humanitarian nature of what I'm trying to do and process. I understand your questions, and I'm just as frustrated as you are with all the things we have to do here. But that's my answer to your question, and I'm trying to keep it that way.
Mr. Chair? Just one follow-up.
Representative Slawik.
So the other thing is when you do introduce fairly big chunks of policy, these special daycare homes, and they're new policy, and typically we would have an interim to look at them and have a group meet and to go through all those types of things, because that one doesn't necessarily have to be done. Right now, are you open to putting some things off that maybe aren't as urgent, or you want us to argue for that, or what's the method to get the point across? And I think it's an interesting piece of legislation. It's just any time you get into licensing, you want to make sure kids are safe. You know, that's just the big concern, and I'm not sure in all of this that piece, we can assure that. We'd want to make sure.
Representative Abler.
Well, it's a fair question. It's a question for this committee and for the body, I guess. I'm open to talk about it. It's actually, if you're talking about letting a licensed home go to an inspected off-site location, is that the piece you're talking about? Okay. Well, that's actually, to my mind, a relatively small change. You've already have the person who's been, the operator has been reviewed. The home has been inspected. The facility there is adequate, but it's a home. There's all kinds of dangerous things in a home. Knives and drawers and, I mean, you know, obstacles in the home. And just to, as I chatted with the department, they said there's actually some safety enhancements from this. And so I'm willing to work with you on it, and it's certainly not my marquee piece, but I think it's one more thing that can make it easier for the system to work well. And that's I'm willing to talk to you about it.
Mr. Chair, if we can work on it,
Representative Slawik.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. Just one more guide, if you could. Are there, do you have in your head at least the sections or areas of the proposal that would require federal waivers to implement?
There's a list. Abler. If you read the language, there's a list of things that require waivers, and we can't take money for that. There's one thing that we are talking about, which is the base bill, which is this global waiver. And so there's language about that. There's a number of, I don't know how many things are waived in there. which is the whole point of asking for a global waiver, which is, we can discuss that now or later if you want. But so, yes, there's things that require waivers.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, we don't need to discuss it now, but is there a framework for the global waiver idea in here already so that when I read through this, I will get a picture of it?
Actually, there's the bill.
House File 937, I think.
House File 937 Okay. was the bill. This is going to be the vehicle bill, and that's actually that bill is the global waiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members of the questions, we are going to wrap up at 2:15, and then we will reconvene. I should say we're not going to reconvene if there are no more questions. I'm just letting our members know that we're planning to wrap up at 2:15, and then we will convene the policy committee at a regular time at 2:30. We have some bills yet to hear. Any other questions? Other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, since we've just kind of got a collection of a whole lot of good language to absorb, and I think part of why you're not getting a lot of questions is because we're still trying to absorb a lot really quickly. Are we going to see House research summaries by each of these chunks? Or, I mean, is there a way that we're going to be able to start communicating with each other about provisions, or are we just going to refer to page something of and just keep sorting through the stack of seven or eight pieces we have here? Or is there a next step? This was kind of the unveiling, and then we're going to get a more integrated packet? Or how do we work with this?
Representative Loeffler, my understanding is all of that will be available online on Monday, including research summaries.
And Mr.
Members, Representative Abel, you have the last word.
I think the members all, let me just give you my number if they all want to call for questions. 612-245-3764. It's also in the green and red book. And I'm not trying to be cute, I'm trying to be true about this. I don't think that this is, nothing's different, nothing's the same about this year. We've never had a Democrat governor and Republican houses. We've never had this kind of trouble. You've never had me for a chair, which there you have. You know? I never thought I would be here doing this. And so there's lots of, and Rep. Chair Gottwalter, whoever would have thought, huh? So here we are. We're all in this boat together. And there's, and so, you know, at least in terms of the policy work. I mean, there's plenty of room for rhetoric, and you have to do whatever you do about that. But in terms of the policy work and the work that we're trying to get done, the better we do, the less people get find themselves in harm's way. And that's my interest. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the audience for their good attention. And thank you, members.
Representative Abler, thank you for your careful work on this. Members, thank you for your patience and participation. We stand adjourned.
What this legislation is about, and what makes 20 weeks significant, is that there is consensus that at least by 20 weeks after conception, the unborn child can feel pain. Pain, and the empathy that we all feel toward those experiencing pain, and is innately human feeling. Every parent whose child is hurt, and every child whose parent is suffering pain due to illness or disease, strives to ease that pain. We have many laws, customs, and traditions that seek to protect others from pain. Should we not extend this to the most vulnerable child, the unborn child? Imagine, if you will, that you are an unborn child as you once were. However, this time, you were diagnosed with Down syndrome. Like more than 90% of these children diagnosed with Down syndrome prior to birth, your mother decided to have an abortion. Nationwide, the most common abortion procedure at this stage of development is a D&E, or in layman's terms, a dismemberment abortion. That means that the doctor reaches in with a forceps, grabs a limb, and pulls until it is ripped off. He removes it, then goes back for the next one, until he has removed every piece of you. If this wasn't done in the womb, it would be a torturous, cruel, cruel death. In America, we call it a woman's choice. In 1973, when Roe v. Wade was handed down, we did not know that the unborn child feels pain. In fact, the medical community didn't even know that newborns felt pain. They routinely performed surgery on them without pain medication. But things have changed in the nearly 40 years since. Doctors discovered that newborns do feel pain, and that it can be measured, just as it is with adults, by analyzing stress hormones. Doctors then saw evidence that unborn children could also feel pain, as detailed in the findings section. Not only do unborn children at 20 weeks after conception have the physiological systems in place to perceive pain, they also move away from painful stimuli, and they have increased levels of stress hormones, coinciding with when one would expect them to feel pain. Additionally, these stress hormones are lowered when the unborn child is provided pain-reducing medication. Today, fetal surgery is a growing medical specialty, as conditions like spina bifida can sometimes be treated before a child is even born. Prior to these surgeries, unborn children are now routinely provided with pain medication. The photo on the screen above me is of a boy, Samuel Armas, who had a fetal surgery in 1999 to correct a spina bifida lesion. Just as the surgeon was about to finish the surgery, young, 21-week-old Samuel Armas reached his arm out and grasped the hand of his doctor. The photographer was lucky enough to be there to snap this amazing photo. It is babies like this that we are seeking to protect today. A pain-capable unborn child, a child who feels pain just as you and I do, is a member of our human family, and we believe is sufficiently developed to be recognized as such and protected by law, just as you and I. This legislation is not so much about stopping abortions as it is about protecting the pain-capable unborn child. We believe that the state has a compelling interest in protecting the life of an unborn child capable of feeling pain. And I urge each of you to support the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rowe. Members, any questions to the testifier? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's difficult testimony to even listen to. Thank you for bringing this this bill to us so that we can have this opportunity to vote in the right way. But this is certainly nothing new. We've heard this data. It's been coming. It's been building. I'm interested in finding out if there are other states who are similarly have grasped this and have taken action to make sure that this is stopped, and if there are other legislatures that are also studying this to make a point by making sure they have laws that prohibit it.
Ms. Rao?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, there is one state so far that has signed into law the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. That is Nebraska. Nebraska passed it last year by a vote of 44-5. So this is mainstream, common sense kind of legislation. Additionally, there are about 10 states that are trying to pass the legislation this year as well. Among those are Kansas, which recently passed it off of their House floor by a vote of 91-30. And earlier this month, on March 9th, Oklahoma also passed this legislation off their House floor by a vote of 94-2. So as I mentioned, this is common sense legislation. This is something that, whether you consider yourself pro-choice or pro-life, we believe that all people should be able to support legislation that would protect the pain-capable unborn child.
Representative Benson.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. How many babies would we be saving from this procedure?
Ms. Rao. Or Representative Holbrook.
Representative Benson. In Minnesota, we do have abortions that take place at this time. In 2009, which is the most recent year that we have information from, There were 8 abortions that took place after this 20-week threshold. If you look back over the last couple of years, in 2008, there were 16 abortions, and in 2007, 11 abortions. Admittedly, this is a very small percentage of the total abortions in Minnesota, but again, we feel that it is very important that the state take an interest in protecting the lives of these pain-capable unborn children.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions at this time? Representative McDonald, Representative Barrett, and Representative McElfatrick. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Rao, question for you. At this stage, at this stage in life, are the babies able to live on their own?
Well, Mr. Representative Fulbert and Representative McDonald, there have been children that have survived at 20 weeks.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for bringing the bill forward. I'm struck by a couple things. I guess the most obvious is the method you mentioned of this type of abortion in which limbs are actually pulled off the body. Is that true?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barrett, yes, that's the D&E abortion. D&E stands for dilation and evacuation. Typically, that is how the procedure is performed. There are other abortion procedures that take place this late in pregnancy as well. Representative Holberg mentioned the saline abortion, and there are a few others as well, but the most common method of abortion at this stage is the D&E.
Representative Barrett.
And then another thing I was really struck by is the kind of the inherent contradiction we have in performing a surgery on a 20-week-old while at the same time allowing for limbs to be ripped off and that child to be killed. So we have, is there any precedent in law related to pain in areas other than performing an abortion that you're aware of?
Representative Fulver?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Baird, I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but I find it a real irony that in states that have the death penalty, they are administered pain medication as a first step in that process. And so, it's really ironic to me, a recognition of pain as inhumane is done in that situation. And I think we need to start talking about what happens to these unborn children.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barrett.
I think what I was referring to is the process of performing surgery on a child that young and whether the doctors use anesthesia or whether they don't during a surgical procedure of a 20-week-old, if you know.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barrett, I guess there's two things I would like to address with your question. First is that, as was mentioned earlier, when doing fetal surgeries, it is standard practice now to provide pain-relieving medication to the unborn child prior to the surgery. They find that they have better outcomes when they provide that, as evidence shows that the unborn child does feel pain at that point in time. So relieving the stress of that pain leads to a better outcome. I'd also like to point out that we do have precedent in Minnesota law recognizing actually the ability of the unborn child to feel pain, including a provision that was passed a few years ago, the Unborn Child Pain Protection Act. And as part of that piece of legislation, it does require that abortionists provide information to women who are at least 20 or more weeks along in their pregnancy that their child may feel pain, and allows them or offers them anesthesia for the unborn child. So we do have precedent already in Minnesota law that has not been challenged or questioned in the number of years that it has been on the books that the unborn child does feel pain.
Representative Barrett.
Just a quick follow-up. I think you had mentioned the law suggests that a baby may feel pain. I think the preceding information you implied or talked about regarding research-based, in which a surgery in which you give anesthesia does make better outcomes. That's, I think we should change that. It definitely does feel pain, which I think you also said. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if
Representative
you
might, Holbert.
I believe there's a salmon-colored handout in your packets that is many, many pages of excerpts from various studies, quotes. It documents some of the changes in medical procedure that would probably give you more information as well.
Representative McElfetrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rao, I don't think I'm probably the only person in this room who finds these descriptions very disturbing. I think anyone with any sensitivity has to be disturbed by this. We all have pretty good imagination, and this is painful to hear. With this much information out here on the unborn capable of feeling pain, I have to wonder what would prompt someone to make a decision to abort a child at this late stage.
Ms. Rao?
Mr. Chair, Representative McElfetrick, of course we don't know exactly what draws any woman specifically to that decision or of a particular woman's case. In Minnesota, we have a number of statistics, as I mentioned, on the number of abortions, the stage in pregnancy, and why they have abortions. But the information isn't tied together. So specifically for the late-term abortions, we don't have specific information as to why. However, we do know that oftentimes with these abortions that happen much later in pregnancy, it is often due to some kind of fetal abnormality or in other cases, sometimes girls who are fairly young and maybe are denying to themselves that they were pregnant and not admitting. Those are some of the reasons, although I can't speculate on why any particular woman chooses to have an abortion at this stage.
Representative McElfetrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but that was kind of like my same question, because there's such a low number of late-term abortions. My question was, do you know the circumstances of why someone would choose to have a late-term abortion? So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Members, our goal here is to allow 10 minutes of other testimony for and against, to be fair and to keep us on track. So, seeing no other questions at this time, we'll move into testifiers for. We have two testifiers for, three testifiers against lined up. Father Andrew Cousins, and we're trying to keep, you can do the math, 10 minutes for, 10 minutes against. Welcome to the committee, Father Cousins. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Father Andrew Cousins. I'm here representing the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and the Minnesota Catholic Conference. Honored to be able to testify to you today on behalf of the 1 million Catholics in the state of Minnesota. And we strongly urge you, representatives, to pass this very important bill. Of course, as already been mentioned, science has come a long way since abortion became legal in the United States 38 years ago. We now know that these children we're talking about in this bill are rapidly approaching viabilities, that is, the ability to survive outside the womb. I myself baptized a baby of 21 weeks just at United Hospital, just a few blocks away when I was the associate pastor at the Cathedral of St. Paul. That baby is alive and healthy today. Of course, it's the sad irony that in a hospital just next door or in other places in Minnesota, a same-age child does not enjoy the protection of law that that child enjoys. Of course, studies show that most Americans are uncomfortable with late-term abortions. They understand the viability of this young life, and they instinctively understand what we're talking about here today, which is that these young children feel pain. Minnesota is also blessed to have lots of help for these women who might find themselves in this situation. We in the Catholic Church stand ready to provide that help through our parishes, through our charities. We will not abandon these women in need. Finally, this bill is important to me on a personal level, which is why Archbishop Neinstedt asked me to come and speak in favor of it today. And that is that when my own mother was 20 weeks pregnant with me, her water broke, and she went to the doctor because of this trouble in the pregnancy, and she was advised at that point to have an abortion, that is, to have the baby, have me induced, and which would be an early term abortion, because tests showed that I was severely deformed. Now, although my sister always argued that there was some truth in that, in fact, although I was born a month early, I was born healthy. There are, in fact, many vulnerable children like myself who have no voice and deserve to have a voice, so I'm happy to speak on their behalf today. And I really encourage you all to vote in favor of this bill. Abortion is too often a permanent solution, an easy solution, and not treated like it should be, which is a very difficult, painful thing. So this is a chance to make it more rare, and let's try to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Father Cousins. Any questions for the testifier? If not, we'll move to the next testifier. Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of this committee, thank you so much for this opportunity today. My name is Micah Olson. I'm a concerned citizen for life. In this testimony, my goal is to persuade all of the members of this committee to support the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. I would like to present to you three compelling reasons why to vote in favor of House File 936. I'd like to mention that in my longer testimony, which should have been received, I explain more in depth in each of my points. Number one, my personal testimony. I have an adopted brother who was born at 23 weeks. He weighed 1 pound and was a little longer than a pencil. The mother was on her way to have an abortion. However, due to some medical issues, she was unable to. Now, under current Minnesota law, my brother could have been aborted. My question for you is, why should unborn Minnesota citizens be subject to such inhumane treatment? Number two, scientific evidence. There has been numerous scientific studies done that have proven that fetuses in the womb at 20 weeks feel pain. Robert J. White, who has a PhD and is an MD, and who is a professor of neurosurgery at Case Western University, has said, an unborn at 20 weeks in the womb is fully capable of experiencing pain. Without question, abortion is a dreadfully painful experience for any infant subject to such a surgical procedure. By studying this quote and others provided in my longer testimony by leading experts, one becomes solidly convinced that it is immoral to slaughter the unborn when they can feel excruciating pain. Number three, the testimony of other states. Numerous other states have been compelled to consider legislation that would outlaw abortion at 20 weeks gestation. Legislation is being considered by Idaho, Indiana, Kentucky, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Missouri, and Arkansas. All of these states have been compelled to consider legislation just like House File 936 because of the overwhelming evidence that unborn feels pain at 20 weeks gestation. Minnesota has a moral obligation to protect the unborn. That is why I support House File 936. And I urge every member of this committee to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, any questions to the testifier? I would also point out that written testimony has been submitted by both of our last testifiers as well as others. Very good. We have a question. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How old are you?
17.
17.
Very good. All right, members, we'll move on to the next testifier. Ms. Alicia Hempel. And other testifiers, if you could make your way up to the seating behind the testifier's table, that will save us some time.
I've never done anything like this before, so please bear with me. My name's Alicia Hempel. I'm a mother, a wife of a veteran, and I'm a special education teacher. This past summer, I became pregnant with what would have been our second child. We are excited to have a new addition to our family. And at one of my appointments, my doctor talked to me about having a screening. where I would have an ultrasound and that my baby would be screened for chromosome disorders. The screening was optional and not typically covered by insurances, but I checked my insurance anyway just so I could have a peek at my baby. After the ultrasound, I was told my baby showed signs of a chromosome disorder. I went for a second opinion and additional testing and had a CVS, which analyzes the baby's chromosomes, and this test confirmed that I had a baby girl and or was having a baby girl and that she had trisomy 18. Trisomy 18 is a chromosome defect that is life-threatening. It's associated with severe intellectual disabilities as well as abnormalities of many body parts. 50% of these babies don't make it to be full term. Of those babies that do make it, only 10% live to see their first birthday. My baby already showed fluid throughout her body and major organs, with suggesting she was incompatible with life. Considering these circumstances, in addition to how this would already affect my two-year-old daughter, my husband had been laid off for most of 2010. We have no family members that live within a 130-mile radius to help us with a baby in this condition. We decided that ending the pregnancy was the best decision for our family. Had I not had that optional screening, I probably wouldn't have found out my baby's condition until my 20-week checkup. With this proposed bill, I would not be allowed to save my baby from the pain that she would have endured for hours, maybe days, and possibly even months until she died. I now belong to a support group of women who've terminated for medical reasons. There are numbers of women that are in this group that I belong to that found out their baby had fatal diagnosis after 20 weeks or later. The founder of this group, Christy Brooks, put together a book called Our Heartbreaking Choices. It contains women who had much-wanted pregnancies and needed to interrupt their pregnancies. In this book alone, there's 15 stories of women who had to terminate after 20 weeks for fatal diagnosis. I urge you to please read this book and these stories before making any kind of decision that would affect future families in my position. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions to the testifier? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hempel. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing what must be a really difficult story to tell. And it's easier, I think, to testify when you're taking a position based on a philosophy or a faith position than it is to tell a very personal, difficult part of your own life. And so I just want to commend you for your courage and thank your support group for being there for you.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you as well, Ms. Hempel. I know you've mentioned you don't do this, and you came in and told us your story, and you really brought up such an important subject to think about. And I'm not even going to begin to talk about the term you use, but trisomy
18.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an area I think a lot of us don't even know about, really. I mean, unless it happens to you.
Because these babies don't live, that's why.
Well, mm-hmm. And regarding that, I had the opportunity to go to an event last year, and it's an organization called Prenatal Partners for Life. And they're a large organization that helps women and children in this condition. Had the good fortune of hearing a former Senator Rick Santorum talk about his personal story of a child he had with that exact or similar condition. Mm-hmm. And he did open my eyes to the fact that a lot of these children are born and they do live a life past infancy. And they are happy kids. And they provide joy and love and support. And they're part of a family. And you obviously made the choice you did. I would like to inform everyone who isn't aware of this, check out Prenatal Partners for Life, because they have a wonderful organization that helps families in your situation understand this issue that a lot of people don't understand. These babies are viable. They are important. They are God's child. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Professor David Schultz. Professor Schultz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Sure, let me just get seated for a second. Thank you very much. My name is David Schultz, professor at Hamline University in the School of Business and in the School of Law, as well as the University of Minnesota in the School of Law. Testimony does not reflect my institutional support or where I teach. I should also indicate that I have both a PhD in political science, a JD, a law degree, and I have probably written more books than I can count on constitutional law and civil rights, civil liberties. I'm here to testify against House File 936, and I could be brief in terms of making 3 points. Point number one is that House File 936, as presently written and drafted, is unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional in several different ways. And think about it, in Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court argued that the constitutional right to privacy was broad enough to protect the right of a woman to terminate a pregnancy. That right was reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey. Roe articulated a trimester distinction or structure to determine the competing rights of a woman versus a state interest in preserving fetal health. Yet, even under this trimester schema, the core holding of Roe articulated that a fundamental right of a woman to terminate a pregnancy. This core holding remains valid today, and therefore House File 936 is unconstitutional under it. Alternatively, Justice O'Connor argued in several cases, such as in Casey and in City of Akron versus Akron versus Akron Center Reproductive Health Services, that perhaps we need to use the undue burden test for determining the constitutionality of restrictions on a woman's right to choose. However, even under that undue burden test, we would find that House File 936 to be unconstitutional in terms of the procedures being subjected or imposed upon a woman would constitute an undue burden. Finally, in Gonzalez versus Carhart, 2007, the Supreme Court upheld a federal law banning so-called partial birth abortions. The decision represents the singular instance of a specific ban on abortion procedure being upheld, but even under Gonzalez, women, even after 20 weeks, still retain a constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy, such that a flat ban on that right, even with the exceptions noted in House File 936, are unconstitutional. And then finally, under the Minnesota Constitution, specifically Article 1, Sections 2, 7, and 10, and according to Gomez, or rather Doe versus Gomez, this also is unconstitutional. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in Doe that the right to privacy under the Minnesota Constitution is broader than the right under the federal Constitution, and so ruled that the right to privacy under the Minnesota Constitution protected a right of a woman to terminate a pregnancy. If, in fact, the right under the Minnesota Constitution is broader than it is under the federal Constitution, and the federal Constitution invalidates this procedure, then most certainly that procedure, as law that's being talked about here, is unconstitutional. My first point, then, it's unconstitutional. Second point, House File 936 invites legislating from the bench in disrespect for the law. There are many people in this room who are very upset by the fact and oftentimes criticize the courts for legislating from the bench, for reaching out and striking down and making policy on their own. Many criticize the judiciary and judges who do this and when they disregard precedent. Courts are bound by precedent. The current precedent in the law bans, or rather invalidates, this type of law and makes it unconstitutional. What you are doing today as a legislature, if you were to pass this, is that what you're doing is encouraging the courts to reach out to strike down legislation. Legislature should not be in the business of encouraging disrespect for the law and legislating from the bench. Instead, you should be encouraging judges to respect precedent, and legislatures should not be in the business of specifically passing laws aimed at encouraging courts, again, as I would say, legislate from the bench.
This Professor, bill, we have about 2 minutes left.
I have 30 seconds to go. I can bring anything under budget and under time. Thank you. This bill, if it were to become law, is inviting. This bill, if it were passed, is inviting and encouraging the Supreme Court to review and reject established precedent. Finally, House File 936 is taxpayer funding for a private lawsuit. What we're essentially asking here is for the state of Minnesota to expend legal resources and money to defend a law that is probably unconstitutional. And I would suggest that at a time when we are facing a $5 billion deficit in the state of Minnesota, don't we have better things to do than to waste our money on defending laws that are clearly unconstitutional? Thank you very much. And had you not interrupted me, I would have been done quicker. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Professor. I appreciate that. We will hold a balance of 1.5 minutes for the third testifier when we come back after questions. So Representative Barrett, Representative Quam, Representative Grinhagen, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question, sir. Who are you again?
My name is David Schultz. I'm a professor at Hamline University in the School of Business and in the School of Law, and I also teach at the University of Minnesota in the School of Law.
Sir, you are a professor at Hamline.
Yes, I am, sir.
And to what extent is your role in as a professor involved this particular bill?
I am speaking,
Professor Schultz.
I am speaking as an expert on the Constitution and constitutional law. I have published over the years about 25 books and about 70 articles, including several leading textbooks and 7 encyclopedias on American law and American constitutional law. I speak here as a constitutional law expert.
Representative Barrett.
Sir, have you ever been a judge?
I have not been a judge.
Okay, thank you.
May I follow up with a comment, though?
Briefly, Professor.
Okay. May not be a judge, but I have looked at the law and have studied it, and it's unconstitutional under current precedent. And if you're going to sort of ask me the question, well, could you be wrong? Yeah, I could be wrong. On the other hand, I haven't blown a prediction on a case in years.
Mr. Chair.
Order, please. Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I wasn't going to ask you if you were, if I thought you were wrong, because I think I know what your answer would be.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schultz, since you're somewhat familiar with the law, what happens, and I believe that there is some penalty if, say, a drunk driver kills a pregnant mother, that's in regards to the unborn child. Is that correct?
Professor Schultz.
I believe it's correct, but I'm not prepared to speak about those specific laws.
Mr. Chairman, he answered
Representative
the question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Does law ever change when new technology presents additional evidence? It's simple, yes or no.
Professor Schultz.
When, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the law changes when the precedent proves to be non-viable in terms of the precedent no longer works. Rarely does the U.S. Supreme Court overturn constitutional precedent, and when it does, it has to be shown that the constitutional precedent didn't work. And as I indicated into my testimony, as early as Roe versus Wade, a court considered the competing interests of a mother's right to privacy and fetal health in terms of drawing the trade-off and weighing in favor of a woman's right to choose.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, since in some cases the life of a unborn child has merit and stature and status, and in fact the courts assess penalties for the loss of that life, I think that there could be, I guess, a little bit of consideration that, you know, of the opinion that there is a human being at some point, and this bill, I think, is just debating at what point you're giving that life sufficient merit, attention, and quality to protect it as a human being. And I think that with the newer ultrasound technology, it becomes even more evident that there is a human being at earlier stages than I think was generally accepted back when precedent was made, as you've stated. So if law acknowledges a human being, if somebody kills a fetus in a car accident, why does not law acknowledge a human being in this bill? Is that not inconsistent, Mr. Schultz?
I will come back Professor and state Schultz. What I stated, Mr. Chairman, Representative, in my testimony, that under the current precedent, this bill is unconstitutional.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Schultz. Oh, by the way, Mary Liz, thanks for bringing this forward, okay? Just a side note. A couple questions for you. Number one, the idea that on one floor of the hospital, or well, let's put it this way. you stated that it was unconstitutional. And why do you think other states, like Nebraska and other states, are trying to pass a similar law?
Mr. Chair, Representative?
Professor Schultz.
Yeah, I can't speak to the motives of other legislatures.
Has the Nebraska law been challenged legally?
My understanding is there's probably, Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are probably challenges being planned or underway. I don't know.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does it strike you, Professor Schultz, as when on one floor of a hospital we're doing neonatal surgery to keep a baby at this number of weeks alive, and on the next floor of the same hospital, possibly we're tearing that child to pieces? Does that strike you as irrational and schizophrenic?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I am not here speaking as a medical doctor. I'm here speaking as a constitutional law professor, and to say to you again that under the current framework, the law is unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
I'm asking you as a human being, does that concern you at all?
Professor Schultz.
Chairman, Representative, I will reiterate again and say that whatever my personal beliefs may be, I am here speaking as a constitutional law professor, and that the current law takes into account the trade-offs and some of the concerns that you're raising here. And again, the law is unconstitutional under the current precedent.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunhagen.
If our current educational system is creating experts with that type of response in terms of a human being, it is a sad day in this state and nation for our public education and higher educational system.
Order, please. Order. Thank you. Representative Grunhagen?
Done. Okay.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Professor Schultz, since you're the only legal expert signed up to testify, and it's clear that this bill is drafted, as understandably, to anticipate a legal challenge because of the previous rulings. Can you tell me, there's a Section 5 here that has legislative findings, and it says that the legislature makes the following findings, and quite honestly, I do not make those findings because I am not a biologist or a trained physician or anything else, and so I cannot stand by those statements because I don't feel like I have studied those and can make those statements, but I assume that they're in the bill for a reason. Would this statement of findings have any special role to play in that the legal challenge that you have had indicated we should anticipate and that the courts would consider? Because we don't typically see these kind of statements in most of the bills we consider.
Sure,
Professor Schultz.
Chair, Representative, again, I can't speak to the content of 5, again, because I'm not a medical doctor or a biologist, but in terms of what becomes important oftentimes for the courts when they're evaluating the constitutionality of legislation is that they oftentimes may look to whether or not there are actual hearings and findings of fact, and those findings of fact may be critical to them in terms of how they review the legislation, how they consider it. And so oftentimes it is true, I think someone pointed out here, that the legislature here does not always include findings of fact in, and that has posed in some situations problems for legislation for the court, for the legislature, for the Attorney General in defending legislation. And so I would say that who's ever drafting this bill is smart if they want to sort of facilitate a challenge by putting the findings of fact in. It helps facilitate the challenge to Roe and to Gomez.
Members, I will remind you that we're going to try to wrap this bill up in 5 minutes. We have one more testifier in opposition, and we have two more bills to get through before we head off to session. So, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, this does give me concern in that we are a policy committee that deals with the health and human services issues, and I feel like I'm being asked to vote on a statement that I would require a lot more information. I think a freshman biology class professor would ask you to have more information to make these findings. And I feel like I've been asked in the last 3 days to vote 3 times on issues that we've had testimony would have already been ruled unconstitutional, even though we've all been sworn to uphold the current Constitution and its current interpretation. And so I am very uncomfortable with this process, and I'll just leave it at that. But I do appreciate your explaining why this particular unusual statement is here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Holbrook.
I don't know if you were in the room, but this bill is going to civil on that, so we'll delve into these issues in the next committee.
Very good point. Representative Moran. Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Schultz, I noticed that you made a real definitive statement that this is unconstitutional. I'm reminded of some justices, chief justices on our Supreme Court, who said a law is always constitutional until a court declares that it is unconstitutional. So a law at this point is being drafted, and the law is on its way to possibly being turned into law. And at that point, and only until after that, when a law such as this or in Nebraska would be challenged in court, do we have that determination. And generally in those cases, you would also have a plaintiff and a defendant of opposing parties, not just a single one, to have clear way to make statements without opposing party having the opportunity to respond. And I think the fetal pain evidence that's being given here has also been very helpful as a finding of fact. Now, the question that I have for you, though, has precedent ever been overturned in a court?
Yes, Professor Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, precedent has been overturned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that answers my question.
Very good. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just basically just a statement here. And thank you for bringing this bill forward, Ms. Holberg. I just want to remind everybody we are talking about a human life. And Norma McCorvey, also known as Jane Roe, she attempted to overturn Roe versus Wade herself. And of course that still is being that hasn't been done. But this summer while I was doing some research and stuff, I came across a poster, and on this poster was a baby in a womb. And the caption of that poster was, "Pretend I'm a tree and save me."
Members, let's move to the final testifier in opposition.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Terrell, thank you for your patience. You have 1.5 minutes under the 10-minute rule.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Ann Terrell. I'm an obstetrician-gynecologist. I'm an assistant professor and division director of general obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Minnesota. Like Ms. Hempel, I've never done anything like this before, and it's much different than I expected. I am here in opposition of Bill 649. In my experience as an OBGYN, the majority of women seeking termination at this gestational age have recently diagnosed severe fetal deformities. These deformities are inconsistent with life or result in horrible delivery situations. These fetuses may not survive to term, they may not survive birth, or they may not survive after birth. We try to make these genetic confirmed diagnoses as early as possible. These are for the most part very wanted pregnancies. They may be the result of infertility treatment. The woman in these situations finds herself extremely distraught, but she is thankful that she has termination as an option, even if she doesn't choose it. Medical safety is crucial. If we remove this option for women, we may force her into having more complicated procedures at later gestational ages.
Dr. Trell, you have a half a minute.
This greatly increases her risk of complications, infertility, and death. Medicine is full of gray zones. If you make certain parts of medical practice illegal, we cannot give proper, responsible, evidence-based care for women. This is not a place for politics. This is medical practice. This bill makes politicians responsible for the medical care of their constituents. I beg you, do not make it illegal for me to practice medicine in the most proper way.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions to the testifier? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Dr. Terrell. I'm looking at the language of the bill, and I know you don't have that in front of you, but on the sixth page, they talk about, the language talks about prohibitions or conditions under which a woman at 20 weeks or beyond could still have an abortion, and one of the exclusions is the psychological or emotional conditions of the woman. And I'm wondering if you could share with us from your experience as a doctor examples of women and their emotional or psychological state when dealing with such situations, which I think have got to be just heartbreaking.
Doctor?
Thank you, Representative Chairman. I think as evidenced by the other woman's testimony, these women go through unbearable, painful decision-making processes, and they're often torn between deciding to have a safe elective procedure at one point in the pregnancy versus risking a more complicated, life-threatening procedure later in pregnancy versus the threats of delivery. Pregnancy is fraught with complications and life-threatening complications, and we don't know when or if they're going to happen. The thing we know about complicated pregnancies and terminations is that the earlier is better, and that's why we try to make these diagnoses as soon as we can, but it takes time to know the answer in many cases. These women can have prolonged depression and anxiety following these types of decisions, regardless of their decision, whether they decide to carry a pregnancy to term or end the pregnancy early.
Mr. Chair?
Briefly, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so in your expert opinion as a physician, does it make sense to separate the physical impairment of a woman from the psychological impairment of a woman in your decision making about whether or not to terminate a pregnancy?
Dr. Trill.
I think any medical decision can be complicated. These are even more so. And we factor in all portions of a woman's decision, emotional, physical, long-term health, and outcome management.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And for the author of the bill, Representative Holberg, I'm wondering if you can help the committee understand why the physical condition of the woman is severed from the emotional and psychological condition of the woman
Representative
in your
Holberg.
Legislation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, it gets back to the balancing of the protection of the unborn and the protection of the woman, and the vibe. I'm sorry, let me back up a little bit. The reason is that the psychological issues can be addressed, but the termination of the pregnancy, that's the end, and trying to balance those factors out. And certainly if the life of the mother is at risk, that's been a standard that's been upheld. But there is an ability to treat the psychological and also save the baby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to finish my statement.
Representative Murphy, one more question,
thank you.
Please.
I don't have a question. I just think
statement.
In my experience as a professional registered nurse, and I think in the testimony that I got from the physician, it is not possible to separate the physical and psychological states of a human being. And so we are risking the health of the mother even when her psychological state is impaired. Thank you.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Terrell, when you're advising women in their and you're testing them for fetal abnormalities, is spina bifida one that you would say is inconsistent with life?
Dr. Terrell?
No.
It's not.
Representative Lohmer?
Okay, good. You know, we've talked a little bit today about, you know, philosophical and and personal, and I appreciate the woman who testified here earlier in her story, and I'm sorry, but I have a personal story as well. My son is 29 years old and was born with spina bifida, and I guess I just like to say that I'm really thankful that he is in our lives. He's 29 years old. He is an amazing, amazing young man, and I'm really thankful that I am on this committee, Health and Human Services Committee, and I see my role here, and I think many of us on this committee see our role here as standing up for disabled people, and I think that we have a moral obligation to protect all people, as someone said, and the unborn, even if they're handicapped, need to be protected. And I, you know, the testimony is clear that there is pain, and I don't think that it's a fair, I don't know, people make decisions for different reasons, but I would like to see us pass this bill. Thank you very much, Representative Holbrook, for bringing this bill forward. We need to protect people in all stages of life and in all conditions of life. It's not our position to choose. Thank you.
Representative Quam, and then Representative Fritz, and then hopefully we can move to a vote. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Terrell, thank you so much for testifying, and thank you for the service you give to the community and to, you know, many people. I just have a simple question. Do you disagree with the fetal pain evidence finding in fact that was presented?
Dr. Terrell.
I've done a complete literature review on the fetal pain, and I think the answer is we don't know. We may never know during my career. And I don't know if it matters. So if we suspect that vaginal birth is painful for the fetus, will you pass a law making vaginal birth illegal and requiring all women to have C-sections? We understand that these are complicated medical decisions, and the fetal pain issue may or may not be important to a woman when she's making that decision. But I don't think that we can make that decision for her.
Representative Quam, Representative Fritz,
Thank you,
Representative Liebling, and then Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that actually was my question. I wanted to ask the doctor if she did believe that in fetal pain, and I think she answered. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I'm glad that I think it was Representative Loeffler pointed out that we didn't have any medical testimony supporting the findings that are in this bill, and I think that's troubling. The other day we heard a bill that was brought here because of a program on KSTP, and we never heard any anything to back up the findings that were to prove the existence of a problem that the bill was then solving, and I think we have the same issue here.
Representative Loeffler, I'm going to respectfully disagree because we specifically referenced this document, and as chairman I can respond in the middle of this conversation. Representative Liebling, we're not going to get into another conversation about it.
Mr. Chair, if
you are stating that there was no evidence provided, there is evidence provided.
Mr. Chair, it is very rude to interrupt me. I do have the floor.
Representative Liebling, you are out of order.
What I am saying, you can answer after I finish speaking, Mr. Chair. I think it is very out of order to interrupt a speaking
member. Representative Liebling, you are out of order. If you want to continue with your comments, please do so. But I'm not going to get into an argument with you about this.
Well, then, please allow me to
finish. I was correcting your information before the committee because you were wrong.
You can tell me I'm wrong after I finish speaking, Mr. Chair. There's no urgency to tell me while I'm speaking. Anyway, I wanted to simply say, first of all, that I'm troubled that there is no medical testimony supporting this bill. And it is not the same thing to have a bunch of things on a piece of paper. There ought to be testimony here and somebody that we could then and talk to. And I'm very glad that the doctor came to testify today. I do want to ask the author, and maybe you want to, I'll make my statement first so that we can finish all of this, but I did want to ask you about a fiscal note on this bill, whether there would be one, because I think that one thing is very clear, and that is that if we were to pass this bill and it became law, that we would have a certain number of births of children with probably quite severe abnormalities, and I would venture to say that probably many of them would qualify for medical assistance, and that we would then be, because of their disability status, and that we probably would then be in the situation of paying for the very costly care. And I'm not saying that that would be the thing that we should think about here, but however, it would impact our budget. And I think we deserve to know about that at some point. My statement would be, you know, I think Representative McElfatrick, or no, it was Representative Lohmer said, you know, it's not our position to choose. Well, Representative, I think it's not. I think it's the mother's opportunity to choose, the family's opportunity to choose. And Representative McElfatrick, you indicated earlier in the testimony today that you didn't know why anybody would do this, would have an abortion after 20 weeks. And in fact, yesterday when we had a long hearing on another abortion bill, I told you a story about somebody very close to me who had one and explained it. And it's exactly this kind of a thing, that a person very dear to me had a very much wanted pregnancy that was through reproductive assisted technologies, tried for a long time, spent a lot of money, became pregnant, and then had a fetus with a very bad abnormality that was probably not consistent with life and may have damaged her ability to have another child. And she made the excruciatingly difficult decision to terminate that pregnancy and then was able to go on and have a healthy child after that because she made that decision, fortunately. And it was excruciating. It's still excruciating. But the point is that this is an area where we as legislators should not have the arrogance to say that we can make that decision for these people who need to wrestle with some of the most difficult things in their own lives. And I think that probably almost every woman who faces this decision has a very, very difficult choice to make. And with good doctors like the one who's here, I'm sure that they consider many different angles of the choice that they have to make. But for us as legislators to have the arrogance to come in and say that we can decide for that family what their choice should be, that just astounds me. You know, yes, we should protect innocent life, and the mother is the first line of that, and she has to decide how she's going to weigh the various factors in that. And that's why I think we should never be saying by law that we're going to put our thumb on the scale and decide that she can't make that very difficult decision. I just find it astounding that we would do that. And that's my statement, Mr. Chair.
Well, and I'm just going to respond to the committee that we indicated we were taking both verbal and written testimony, and that testimony included the document before you, which contains a great deal of scientific medical evidence that indicates that there is, in fact, pain to the fetus. And with that correction, we'll move on to the next testifier. Representative Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm glad you mentioned the fact that the fetal pain, the evidence, and the website as well, www.doctorsonfetalpain.org. So I think we do have quite a bit of ample evidence being submitted here be introduced. I'm glad to see that was recognized. In particular, for me, we have the issue here that we have the mother and then we have another life. It's an interesting thing to note that the life is so distinct and so separate that you have the spermal DNA and you have the ovarian DNA, ovary DNA, and those two things come together for a separate and distinct brand new life. The DNA is so distinct that indeed in regards to donating of body parts that children to their parents are often incompatible. The DNA is that distinct. And so there are others that are more experienced and more knowledgeable in regards to those issues, and I know that in further testimony those may be available. But that very obvious distinction that you have two lives, not just one life. You have two lives. And to grant to one life the ability to just decide about the other life, that they don't even have a chance at being born and making some of those determinations themselves, is really, I think, true arrogance. It isn't that it isn't a difficult situation, but it is certainly one that I think we in public policy and the recognition of two separate and distinct lives
and balancing the interests of those two is relevant to us as a committee as far as public policy. I think it's also interesting that in the studies that have gone through before and the process of birth, that the process of birth itself and most generally ways of being born, the vaginal birth, that it is generally helpful to the baby, that the compression of the baby's body and the effect that it has on the lungs and that process is generally beneficial. I don't see any of that coming from an abortion, no matter how it is done. So I think certainly this is something that is worth it for us at this time to consider as public policy, but also to make the affirmative statement that we do have two lives here that we are considering. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. First of all, to Representative Liebling, as far as our being arrogant in telling someone what she may or may not do, I think perhaps even more arrogant is to place ourselves in a position where we are choosing death for a defenseless, innocent human person. I think that's very arrogant. And then we've gone so far from the conversation now, the doctor may not even remember, but I just wanted to be sure I heard her correctly. And as I said, we're several minutes down the road from the conversation, but I believe I heard her say that even if the unborn does feel excruciating pain, it doesn't matter.
Dr. Terrell?
I was saying that it very well might matter to the mother or the parents of that fetus. It doesn't tell us how to practice medicine. It doesn't tell you how to write laws. It's a personal, private discussion and a personal, private decision. And we don't know the answer.
Representative McElfatrick.
People generally abuse their children in private as well. Does that make it right?
We'll let that be a rhetorical question unless you want to respond, Dr. Terrell.
I have no authority in that matter.
Okay. Representative Holberg, any more, any closing comments on your bill?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate everybody that came to testify today, and if there's no other questions, I know your committee time is short.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 936 be recommended to pass the bill forward. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 936 be recommended to pass and be re-referred, as amended, and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Order, order. The next bill is House File 795, Representative Hoppe. Welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 795 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm a little surprised. I was assuming everyone was waiting for this bill.
We were.
Mr. Chair, I thank you and thank members of the committee, and I have Heidi Shea with me, who is a constituent of mine and can explain why we're here and why we're doing this bill.
Ms. Shea, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Heidi Shea. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm the mother of two wonderful children that are not being financially supported by their father, who lives in Bermuda. We've been trying to get legal and government support for 7 years, but have received no help because no one knew how to handle an international child support case without reciprocity already in place. There are currently 9 states with this reciprocity agreement for child support between their state and Bermuda. My divorce was granted in Minnesota in 2005. My ex-husband paid child support for a short while and then stopped when he realized that I couldn't enforce the order in Bermuda due to the lack of a reciprocal agreement. In addition, Hennepin County Child Support Services would not initially open my case because the state does not have reciprocity with Bermuda. In 2007, I went to court. The judge ordered Hennepin County Child Support Services to take my case and open an account. They did, but only acted in an account monitoring capacity, which meant nothing. In 2009, I was granted a change of venue to Carver County for my child support case. The Carver County Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Stanfield charged my ex-husband with a felony for failure to show, and a bench warrant was issued. Child Support Services told me that they can't do anything further unless he enters the country, which he won't do. As a result, he hasn't seen the children in nearly 3 years. My former spouse owns a successful contracting business with hard assets, and he is entirely capable of paying child support. He simply relies on the fact that the state of Minnesota doesn't have jurisdiction over him without reciprocity while he resides in Bermuda. I have since remarried, and we are now the modern-day Brady Bunch, 5 kids in all. It's wonderful, but not exactly like the TV show. I've been laid off twice in the past 2 years due to the economy. My former spouse now owes me over $53,000 in unpaid child support, and my new husband pays over 60% of his income to his ex-wife in alimony and full child support for 2 minor children, one who now lives with us full-time, and his youngest only lives with her 50% of the time. Net-net, one out of four parents is supporting 5 children on 40% of his income. I'm desperately trying to secure full-time employment, and my former spouse, who has chosen not to financially support his children, and the remaining parent has chosen not to work and simply collect 60% of my husband's income. The system is broken, and we need to try and fix it one challenge at a time. According to Bermuda laws on child support maintenance, quote, a registered order made by courts in reciprocating countries may be enforced in Bermuda as if it had been made by the registering court and as if that court had had jurisdiction to make it, and proceedings for or with respect to the enforcement of any such order may be taken accordingly. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I need a child support reciprocity agreement in place. I ask the state of Minnesota to draft legislation to enter into a reciprocal agreement with Bermuda. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shea, for your testimony. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And when we started looking into this, I didn't really know what we were getting into. And we found out that the federal government, the U.S. government, has these agreements with larger countries, and that countries like Bermuda, it's left up to individual states. So what if we pass this bill, we send a letter, the Attorney General from Minnesota will send a letter to Bermuda, they will agree to accept it, we hope, and then we'll have a reciprocal agreement with Bermuda for the sponsor of this bill and for anybody else. And if Bermuda refuses, I'm willing to go down there and look into it. and that's it. We'll stand for any questions.
Members, questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hoppe, this seems like a really reasonable thing to do. I'm sorry, the testifier, sorry to hear about your situation. The question is, you started to get to it in your explanation there, but I assume there are other countries that we're in the same situation as Bermuda, and I'm just wondering, do we have to come back and have one constituent come and ask us every time, or is there a way to kind of take care of this all at once by saying, we'll do it for whatever country, and, you know, or what's the situation? How many countries do we have that we would have to go through this with and have a separate bill?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. The short answer is I don't know how many countries, and what we found out is that we don't want to do this with any countries that we don't have to. So hopefully this will never occur with Bermuda again, and there, I don't know how many countries there are in the world, 150 or 160. I think we only have these kind of agreements with less than 50. So most of those countries, we don't have the agreements, and we don't, the Attorney General's office in the state of Minnesota, and I'm not speaking for them, but it's my understanding that they don't want to have these agreements unless we have to do it. So it's a good question, and I had the same one. Evidently, we can't just do a blanket letter to every country in the world. I'll find out from the Attorney General. Maybe they do want to do something, but it's my understanding that they want to do it on a one-off situation in cases where the federal government doesn't.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe we'll just have to look for the good countries where we want to go there to help out.
Well,
but thank you for that. I'm just, of course.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I think that is an excellent idea. And Representative Gottwald, I don't know what your committee budget is, but I'm willing to use it.
We might be able to find it. I don't know. It's a tough budget year. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hoppe, I think this is a good piece of legislation and seems to be a very reasonable, and certainly that I will support this, especially if you'll take me with you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, get your things packed and wait at the airport. I'll pick you up there.
All right. Members, any other questions to the testifier, the author, to the bill? Anybody else wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 795 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. Thank you, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Our next bill, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that the page went to get Ms. Representative Hayden, but if he doesn't show up, I'd be glad to. He's coming. Thank you. Present it.
Representative Hayden, welcome to the committee. We'll give you a second to get things ready to go. And while you're doing that, I can move it, or you could move it.
Oh, you can move it. Yes,
I'll move it. All right. House File 311. I'll move that House File 311. We'll move it, and it's to be laid over for possible inclusion in the policy omnibus bill. So.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's good to be back in the committee that I once was in, and good to see all the happy faces, and just bring you a nice, easy bill that'll be easy to understand, and it's about good reform and great outcomes in our with our service providers. House 5311 addresses contract arrangements between counties and between county and a provider in that county, and we'll explain a little bit more. Minnesota Statute 256.0112 governs financial arrangements between counties when one county places a child for treatment in a residential facility in another county. The host county negotiates a per diem rate with that treatment provider. The residential treatment provider does not have to negotiate with the 80-plus counties. House File 311 will allow counties to supplement the host county contract with performance and outcome requirements. Hennepin County began to use this performance contract in 2009, and they want to be able to apply this approach with placements in out-of-home treatment. The supplemental performance requirements allow some provider to earn enhanced payment for cost-effective outcomes. It will improve communication and accountability between counties and providers. To speak to the bill, Mr. Hotz, Kurt Hotz from Hennepin County Human Service, who is widely known as the preeminent guru on outcomes and performances and numbers in Hennepin County, which of course is our biggest county in the state. So he knows a little bit what he's talking about, and I'm going to turn it over to him, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Guru Hotz, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I am Curtis Hotz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Director of Internal Services for the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department, although I will pass on the label of guru. I don't take that one at all. I am here today to testify in support of House File 311. As Representative Hayden indicated, Minnesota Statute 256.0112 governs counties in the contracting and the provision of social services. Subdivision 6 provides an economical model by allowing the use of host county contracts. This allows counties to access services which are not available in their own county without having to go through the process of writing a new contract. It is also efficient for service providers who don't have to manage 87 separate county contracts. However, at times, counties may want to expand on the provisions written in a host county contract. The amendment, as proposed in House File 311, allows us to do so with respect to out-of-home placements. Again, as Representative Hayden noted, in 2009, the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners directed our department to expand the use of pay-for-performance contracts. To date, we have about 100 contracts in place that contain those elements. One area that is, for the most part, out of reach for us is the provision of services for youth placed in residential treatment centers and group homes, because many of these facilities are outside of Hennepin County. Out-of-home placement costs are significant for Hennepin County. In 2010, we had 281 children just in residential treatment and group homes, costing us over $15 million. The use of pay-for-performance for these services is a considerable opportunity for better outcomes for the children being served and long-term savings for the taxpayers. The amendment proposed in House File 311 would allow an individual county, if it chooses, to negotiate a supplemental agreement with the out-of-county facilities, while leaving the basic terms and conditions negotiated between the provider and the host county in place. No other county would be bound by the terms of that supplemental agreement. As outlined in the proposed legislation, the intent is to encourage funding tied to improved client outcomes that are both timely and cost-effective, rather than just paying for days of service. Pay performance contracts can create greater accountability for the provider and at the same time, allow a high-performing facility to earn more than just a per diem rate, thus sharing in the long-term savings accrued to the taxpayers. On behalf of Hennepin County, I encourage your support for House File 311. I am available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hayden, I did have a question on line 1.15. I noticed that it mentions the per diem rate allowed under this subdivision must not be less than the rate established in the Lee County contract. There's no fiscal note associated with this bill?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of, but
for
most of the children placed in these facilities, it's a county property tax. Sometimes we're able to leverage federal Title IV-E funding. And so there's really no state funding involved in the placements.
Very good. Thank you. Members, any other questions? Any other questions? Anybody else wanting to testify on the bill? Seeing none, we'll lay over this bill for possible inclusion, House File 311, for possible inclusion in the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, I told you. Policy bill. Thank you, Representative Hayden. There will be no joint committee meeting tonight. We had talked about doing that if we needed to, but we wrapped up our discussion earlier today, and we will not be meeting again this evening. There being no other business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.